Hey there, this is Seth Juarez again back. We're here in Austin, Texas at ChefComp. If you have any questions for our next guest, make sure to submit it via Twitter using the hashtag ChefConfLive. It's been really fun to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad you're here.
So tell us who you are and what you do, my friend.
So I'm Justin Arbuckle. I'm the Chief Transformation Officer, VP of Transformation at Chef. I help large companies think about how to make the transition from what they've been doing to what we think they need to do in order to be high velocity product development companies.
And I love how you sort of like look up a little bit like, how do I say this nicely?
Right.
Because it feels like there is some systemic challenges with the way we deliver value with software. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, historically, and I've been a CTO in industry for 20 years, historically we have operated in highly siloed environments. And those siloed environments have resulted in us understanding the value that we create in terms of our local environments that we operate in.
Right.
I'm the dev guy from this team, I'm the test guy from this team, I'm the systems administrator from this team. And so from that perspective, we define our value, we define what we do in that chain just in terms of us.
And what we
have to start doing is we have to start understanding that value is defined by virtue of getting great software into the hands of customers.
And sometimes those silos have competing priorities which are causing disruption and effectiveness.
Those silos will always have competing priorities. Because the reality is that if you are part of a siloed process, what that means is you will have a requirement for when you accept work. And you will have a requirement for when you think that work is ready to pass on.
Right.
Those requirements may not be in sync with the requirements of people further down the chain. Why? Well, because you happen to be a test guy and you happen to be measured on the fact that you have to achieve a certain test coverage. Does that really help your product owner?
Not really.
Not necessarily, right? Because what the product owner is looking for is, do we have a piece of software from which I can get some feedback from the customer?
So we joked around a little bit that your title should be Chief Disruption Officer.
Absolutely. Please, if people on Twitter, reach out, create the meme, make Justin Chief Disruption Officer.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, like a lot of what you do, maybe more than half is not technical.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that aspect.
Yeah, so most of the work that I do is working with CIOs, CTOs, and people in the product teams.
Right.
So often business leaders, often people who are responsible for understanding and prioritizing the work of an actual product that customers use.
Right.
And a lot of the change that we're beginning to see are from business people understanding their change in role, where people in large enterprises are moving from being essentially product managers, managing a spreadsheet of numbers about how much money we're getting from a certain product, what's on this massive backlog of 3 years worth of work that we're never going to get to, towards beginning to think in a far more incremental fashion about what can I build to get a certain amount of feedback from my customer so that I can then iterate it and improve on it and continually over small iterations chip away at creating a great customer experience. And this is a completely different model. And so it requires behavior change, not only from technologists, where we have to understand how to work as a single team, devs, operations, infrastructure management people, but also we have to understand how to operate as a single team with our product owners,
right,
with our business colleagues, and those business colleagues have to understand how to be part of a single team that is in actual fact obsessive about delivering value to their customer. This is Christmas come early for product people.
Right.
It has never been better. There's never been a better time to be a product person than it is now.
Well, it seems like instead of optimizing for arbitrary siloed metrics, we're optimizing for...
You say it so much better than I do.
No,
that's such a great way of
but
saying it.
Your accent automatically makes you smarter
thank
than
you,
me.
Thank
so
you,
just,
thank
you.
Thank you. We like to think so.
So instead of delivering arbitrary sort of siloed metrics, we're looking at delivering bits that can provide feedback, bits that you that provide value right away.
Yeah.
So as a, someone that, that sort of organized, is in charge of this, sort of organizing this, how do they measure, like what bits should they be putting out?
Right.
What value should they be looking at?
Right? That's a great, so I've been talking to a lot of customers and doing a lot of presentations over the last 2 days. And the more I work with organizations and teams that are beginning to jump over this chasm, right, of from the old stuff moving into the new, the only thing that matters is velocity. It's literally measuring how fast you can get a single line of code from idea through to production. And the reason why that is the only thing you need to measure, particularly when you're early in the game, is because when you see that you are not improving in velocity, it creates a crisis where you have to ask why. And once you ask that question why, it helps you begin to look for the bottlenecks that exist.
Right.
Sometimes those bottlenecks will be those silos. Sometimes those bottlenecks will be team issues, where the team is not effectively collaborating, right? And so in this way, the idea of measuring how fast we are getting something to production is in actual fact the best narrative for change. We used to think that in actual fact, the narrative of change in an organization was all about culture. Culture's critical, but there's so much to change. What do you change? What is culture?
Right.
You know what culture is? Culture is how we do things around here. And how we do things should be deliver stuff to production fast. So when we find that we're not improving our speed, we ask ourselves the question, why? When we answer that question, we say, you know what? Turns out we have a problem between dev and ops. Classic problem, where the infrastructure guys and the operations people
right.
not responsible. Okay, go fix that problem. A little bit later, we discover that in actual fact, we're still not speeding up. And it turns out that where we can really start improving right now is we can start improving with how developers within the same team are communicating on certain requirements. Great, let's fix that. And so in this way, the creation of feedback by the process of literally chasing velocity itself is critical. And then from a product point of view, if you're not getting to market at high velocity, and if you are not creating regular increments to improve your product in the market, well, you're not getting feedback from the customer.
Right.
Meaning, you're anticipating what the customer wants, as opposed to actually giving them what they want. Either way, the answer is velocity.
So how does one measure velocity? Is it time to, you wrote a piece of code to someone's using it?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, velocity can be a very simple measurement, which is how long does it take us, and for your team, do you know how long it's gonna take your team to get a story on your storyboard, right? How long does it take your team to get a story all the way through into the hands of the customers? You know, after over a period of time with a little bit of experience, what we find is teams start working in smaller increments, 2 week sprints. My opinion, a lot of this high-minded thinking around estimation is in actual fact an illusion.
Right.
It's an illusory benefit. You start having teams that understand how much work they can do, and you say, you know what, how much can you do in 2 weeks? Oh, I can do these, we think we can do these 10 things. Great. Whether you use t-shirt sizing, Fibonacci numbers, whatever, does it really matter?
Right.
And you know what? What matters is we are increasingly seeing that this team is able to get more of those things, right? Through to production, into the hands of customers.
That's interesting.
It's that simple.
Like, you're turning estimation on its head by instead of saying, when can we get these things done, to how much can we get done in this time?
That's absolutely right.
It's like
that's
the complete opposite.
Right. That's absolutely right. So there's a movement called No Estimates, and there's a great book out on it by a guy called Woody Zale. And you know, a lot of the estimation conversations that we do, in my opinion, particularly for large pieces of work,
right,
are essentially theater.
Yeah, of course.
We're pretending that we can in some way estimate in a meaningful way how much more work this thing is than that thing and ascribe a number to it. Generally speaking, if we have high performing teams, we sit down in those teams and say, okay, let's look at these stories. What kind of granularity are they at? Well, they're at a kind of granularity where I'm not sure I'm able to estimate them. Okay, so let's break them down. Excuse me. What can we deliver? And so in that process, you begin to develop a team that understands what its actual capability is.
And that's interesting because, again, instead of estimating based on we want to get these things done, how long will it take, instead of it's you have this much time, what can you do?
Right.
And that to a developer is less squishy.
Yeah, and it's less intimidating as well. Yeah. You also spend less time on the theater of estimation.
Right.
Why? Because the number one thing we're focusing on is velocity.
Right.
So everything that slows you down from getting something into the hands of the customer is waste.
Right.
So stop doing it.
So that's an interesting perspective. We talked a little bit about sort of the culture.
Blame my son for the cough, by the way.
Oh, man, don't cough on me. No hugs.
Children, sorry. Yeah. Carry germs.
We'll have to do the elbow hug-offs.
We'll do that elbow thing.
So you talked a little bit about the culture
change
that needs to happen. How does the tooling that Chef provide help ease, sort of grease the wheels of that change?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, fundamentally what we found is that in order to effectively collaborate across teams and across functions, what we find is that there are some just basic practices that work. Mm-hmm. So we've embedded those basic practices into the actual operation itself and into the software. And so what that software now does, what the workflow solution does, is operationalize those core behaviors of development, test, bringing everything together in union, creating a rehearsal before we develop and move into production, having automated tests as we go through. And so in this process, we're able to run a series of automated tests for both the application component and the infrastructure component. So we have application as code, we have infrastructure as code. Everything is code.
So I heard a lot about automation. I heard a lot about code.
Uh-huh.
So, like, how, as a developer, because I know how to write code for my stuff.
Yeah.
But now it seems like you're adding an additional sort of coding practice of adding sort of code for infrastructure, code for tests, which we should be doing. And now with the compliance stuff that you're doing, code for compliance, right? So how, as a dev, do I start to discipline myself to do those tasks as well?
So what we're finding is that you know, very often the core configuration management components, so the recipes for building a server, let's say, will very often be written by people other than the devs in a large organization.
Right.
However, what the devs do need to know and understand is how to consume those recipes. They also need to know how to understand when we need to make changes to those recipes. So one of the incredible things that we can do is, imagine you have a standard operating system build, Red Hat, right? Microsoft, right? So whatever that build happens to be, we want to be able to roll this out across the entire organization. Chances are, though, every single development team out there is going to want to make some small changes.
Of course.
Why? Well, because unless you are dealing with a smaller, newer company, and you're dealing with the large enterprises that I deal with, they have to make changes for their legacy.
Of course.
And so, how do you maintain the standard? So the interesting thing is that this workflow allows us to say, you know what, every single time I'm deploying to an Azure server, I'm going to implement this particular build process. But then what I'm going to do is I'm also going to write some code on top of it that takes that and says, yep, I'm using that standard, but now I'm going to extend it and change it a little bit. So what have we got? We now have an audit trail, not only for that standard build, so we know that that's still the standard, but we now have an audit trail in source control for the every single project and how every single project is changing that core image.
I see.
And so what we now begin to do is give developers greater power, greater control over the environments that they're building. But at the same time, we begin to give the enterprise tools to understand how they are managing quality and standardization across it. Now, the same thing goes from a compliance point of view. If we are writing compliance tests, an individual team may decide that there are, within the context that they're developing, that certain CIS standards, perhaps, are not as relevant for them, or maybe less relevant at this stage in the project. So they choose to continue to develop even though they happen to be failing the tests.
Right.
And that's okay. But what we're now not doing is developing unconsciously. So we're creating clarity throughout the process in terms of compliance with security standards,
right,
as well as infrastructure standards. And then, of course, what the workflow itself becomes is it becomes an enterprise standard for how we build software.
I see. And what's interesting is that with the stuff I saw with Chef, I must admit I didn't know as much about Chef as I would have liked, but in the keynote this morning I saw that there's the Chef that I understand, which has the recipes and the cookbooks,
yeah.
But then you have also Habitat, and,
yeah,
then the compliance one, which was Inspect.
Inspect, yeah.
Inspect, and these three things sort of can live on their own.
Right, right.
But tell us a little bit more about Habitat,
yeah.
Because I understand Chef for sort of like infrastructure recipes.
Uh-huh.
What does Habitat do that's different from that?
Right, so if you look at your typical, architecture for one of your least favorite applications in your enterprise today,
sure.
You'll find that there are many layers. You're gonna have the operating system, the environment that it runs in, the web environment, orchestration, goes all the way up.
Right.
And of course, when you begin to think about how you manage the complexity of retargeting that to another environment, when you begin to understand how to reduce the complexity of getting that environment to have a particular standard build, a standard quality of run, right? While at the same time beginning to change a variety of components within it, perhaps, or perhaps change some of the core services. Let's just say we decide to start changing the orchestration layer for the enterprise as a whole.
Right.
How do you manage the complexities? It begins to be a many-to-many problem, right?
Right.
And you're beginning to run into this problem of, well, I've got this version of Kubernetes over here, and I have this version of Mesos over there. I've got this application that uses it in this way, and I've got that application that uses it in this way. I want to move that application to this data. How do
it's
you do
a mess.
This? It's a mess. So what Habitat does is essentially it means that all of the configuration of the whole application travels with the application. So what Habitat allows us to do is take all of those many layers and essentially write a profile that describes all of the resources that that application needs within all of the layers of its operation and dependencies, and also awareness of all of the other resources out there, perhaps other Habitat applications that it's going to be dependent on.
So this is I'm trying to understand, because if I'm writing like a web application,
yeah,
I have this stuff running on my, let's just say it's just a end tier, you know, I have the middle, uh-huh, thing, I have the database, and then,
yep,
the web server, right?
Yep.
Does that Habitat sort of describe the web server, the middle tier, and the database at the same time?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it tells you all of the resources that you need in order to be able to run that application.
How is that different than a Chef recipe?
Right, so what a Chef recipe does is imagine that every single one of the components inside, every single one of the components that application relies on, let's say the application server.
Right.
That application server is going to be configured by a Chef recipe. So the Chef recipe will say, all right then, JBoss, we need you to operate in this way. You're going to be expecting a database connection through the following ports to this particular database. That's what the Chef recipes will do. These ports are open, these ports are closed. You're secure here, you're less secure here, right?
Right.
That's what standardized configuration means. What Habitat does is take that configuration and all of the other dependent configurations, right? And all of the resources that Tomcat or JBoss or something like that relies on in order to run that application, packages up the resources and packages up the configuration into one individual package.
Interesting. So if you're like writing a Ruby on Rails application, like it would set up the actual web server, the recipe would.
That's it.
And then Habitat would know the particular gem files you're using.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Exactly right. Would also know the resources. Let's say you were running it in a Microsoft environment.
Right.
Would know the Microsoft resources, the libraries that it needs to use in order to run the actual Ruby environment.
I see.
In order to serve the actual website itself.
Now, does Habitat sort of pull the gem every time, or does it store the gem? Because you can imagine a scenario where I'm writing this Ruby on Rails application, I use a gem file from yesterday, and then a new one comes out that hoses everything. Yeah. Will Habitat pull the new gem file or use the one that you specified?
Either one. So certainly what we've had for a long time in Chef is the ability to be able to pin. So we can pin a particular version of a recipe or a cookbook, because sometimes we don't want to update.
Right.
Right? But sometimes you want to constantly be managing to the new version. But in many cases, for legacy applications, you're probably going to want to keep a fairly static set of resources.
Right.
So a good example are some old Windows applications, right? So some older Windows applications that organizations want to migrate to the cloud, manage individually as they begin to take advantage of the awesome new stuff you guys are doing. Well, you're going to be using, you know, some of the old WinDLLs and things like that. They're going to stay the same.
That's interesting. So it feels like Habitat versus sort of the Chef. What's the original Chef called? The original Chef recipe program?
Chef server.
So that is dealing more with these are the kinds of machines that the kind of stuff we need on the machine, and this is the kind of stuff you need for your application.
And this is wrapping all of the resources we need, including the stuff you need for your machine, into a single package that moves wherever you want to go.
So you have Chef Server, you have Habitat, and you have Inspect. It feels like those things on their own need to be managed centrally, and you had announcements about how you do that. Now, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we have, essentially, the exciting thing about Chef has been our open source roots. And what our open source roots really have meant is that we want to ensure that Chef continues to grow as an open source product.
Right.
InSpec, which is really a world-leading framework, has an open source component, and we're already beginning to see some great contributions from the community where they're extending and making their organizations compliant and more secure using it, right? And then, of course, the same thing goes for Habitat, where we're starting to see a whole bunch of people beginning to contribute. This is where Chef comes from. This is what makes us Chef.
Right.
But what we've done is we've actually wrapped on top of that our tools around the workflow itself, which is Chef Workflow, and our tools around visualization, which is Chef Insights. And essentially, if we wrap those tools around it into a platform we call Chef Automate. So what Chef Automate now provides in a single commercial offering is the ability to be able to use all of these open source tools, which are evolving at the rate of community development.
Of course, which is fast.
Which is super fast, but wrapping around them some enterprise-grade capabilities around managing the workflow, assuring that that workflow is enterprise-ready and compliant, and then, of course, visualizing what your environment looks like, what your development process looks like, what your server state looks like, et cetera.
And that's interesting, right? Because of the nature of Chef and its sort of open source roots, the kinds of heterogeneous environments that are being created with Chef is kind of exploding. I mean, you could have half of your application written in Scala and the other one in Ruby and then the other one using .NET Core.
Right,
and that could all be managed using Chef.
That's exactly
But the thing over the top is sort of making homogeneous what heterogeneous environments are happening below.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And you know what's really important about the workflow is that the workflow tool allows us to manage with a single workflow, as I said earlier, both application code and infrastructure code. But that application code can be anything. And the infrastructure targets we're talking about can be anything.
Right.
And given that Habitat has such fantastic integration with containers, like Docker and that sort of thing, it can be any environment that you're running in. And so now what we have is a single tool to manage not only what application you're writing, but the target that you want to put it onto, also the rules from a security and compliance point of view that your environments need to pass, Center for Internet Security, for instance. But you can also put rules for the compliance within the workflow into the workflow tool itself.
Interesting.
And so we now have a single place to create an enterprise-grade workflow for the organization.
And that's interesting, right? Because I think that one of the challenges with open source in the enterprise is this fear of managing heterogeneous things that hitherto have been unmanageable.
Right.
Right, yeah. And I love the way that you're sort of putting it all together. So we're kind of running out of time. What are some resources that you provide as Chef to help people sort of get started along this path of cultural and technological change to deliver speedily and at velocity?
Right, well, there's a couple of things we can talk about. Firstly, on the website, we've got some great learning materials. They've just come along so far in the last year. So please go to learnchef.chef.io. And what we've also done is, from an organizational point of view, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing, as we said in the beginning, was working with companies make this transition. And so what we've done is we've actually open sourced the practice of running our transformation workshops. So people can go and see that stuff and contribute to it and download it. It's under Creative Commons Share Alike, and it's at continuoustransformation.org.
That's awesome.
So those are two cool resources. We'd love to get your contribution.
And you all are based out of Seattle, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, our head office is in Seattle. We've got offices in London. We've got offices in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I've been doing a bunch of work recently in New Zealand.
Fantastic.
We're a truly global company.
Well, you know, if you're ever in Seattle again, you come by our studios and maybe you could help deliver some of those messages.
Sounds
on
great.
Transformation,
how
Look you can
do to
that.
It.
It's been really a pleasure talking to you, my
it's
friend.
It's been great.
We are again here at in Austin for ChefConf. You've been watching a lot about how to transform your organization to deliver software at velocity with some wonderful tools that the folks at Chef are building. Thanks so much for watching the live portion of the show. Tomorrow we're going to be recording some more sessions. They are going to be recorded, but we want to make sure that you can watch them, so we'll have them up at Channel 9. Thanks so much for watching. My name is Seth Juarez, and we will see you next time. Take care.